Hello, it's Wednesday the 9th of June. I'm Jim White, standing in for the great Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Today, house prices seem to be heading into orbit faster than Jeff Bezos. We'll be finding out why. Can the office make a comeback, or will we still be working from home in years to come? And what on earth is Roy Keane's beef with Jordan Henderson? Stay tuned, and we'll be hearing all. On Monday, Downing Street sources confirmed that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is not a fan of the term special relationship as a way of describing the UK's friendship with the United States. Joe Biden had used the phrase earlier this week, but the PM is said to feel it implies that UK is needy and weak. The expression is thought to have been coined by Winston Churchill at the start of the Cold War and has been used by prime ministers and presidents ever since. Biden, Johnson and leaders of the other G7 countries will gather from this Friday in the Cornish resort of Carbis Bay, and the US president will meet the Queen at Windsor Castle on Sunday. But let's talk about that special relationship. And joining me is Scott Lucas, Emeritus Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. Scott, thanks for joining us. Does the US genuinely see its relationship with the UK as special, or is this just a bit of diplomatic flim-flam?
Well, I think the special relationship on both sides of the water has always made for a useful soundbite. And indeed, it's been a very useful myth. For example, think about during the Cold War. You mentioned the fact that Winston Churchill had coined the phrase in 1946. Well, that was at the same time he was talking about the need for an alliance against the Iron Curtain from Stettin on the Baltic to Trieste on the Adriatic. Think about the 1980s with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, or more recently the relationship that was held up between McMillan and Kennedy, between Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, and indeed between Tony Blair and George W. Bush after 9/11. But I do think it is largely myth in the sense that, you know, for many Americans, and I include my parents amongst us, all they've ever known about England is, and I've lived here 35 years, is they know the Queen and they know the comedian Benny Hill, and that's it. I think, you know, what England, not even the United Kingdom, but what England is actually beyond the day-to-day experience of many Americans. And I think the fact is that the power position of the two countries is so different. I mean, the United States, has been, the most powerful country probably since 1945. The United Kingdom has had to retrench, and indeed is having to retrench its power once again after Brexit, which is part of the reason why Boris Johnson has made this statement. That the special relationship, it's a bit of political spin. Doesn't mean it hasn't been without its use in the past, but it is largely political spin.
That's interesting. You mentioned Brexit. I mean, presumably that's impacted the UK's importance in the eyes of the US, has it?
I think even before Brexit, we were seeing that in reality, the United States was not, as it were, putting a priority on the relationship with Britain, but it was putting the relationship with Britain within, you know, amongst others. For example, the relationship with Asian countries amidst the rise of China, the relationship especially with the European countries and the European Union alongside NATO. And indeed, you know, the Biden administration, I think, probably puts more weight on where it repairs relations with the EU as a priority than on the UK, because, again, the reality of politics is European Union, 27 countries, the UK is only one. I think that realignment, however, has been reinforced by Brexit in this sense, and that is that the United Kingdom, and whether or not you believe Brexit is desirable, the United Kingdom has gone its own way. And that has meant that it doesn't have the same economic weight as the European Union. It's not going to get this trade deal with the United States in the near future. It's not going to get major trade deals, except possibly with Australia, in the next couple of years. And it also means that the UK has disrupted its military security and intelligence relationships, which have been the bedrock of what you might want to call is the special link with Washington, because the U.S. looks at the military, diplomatic, and intelligence relationships as part of its relationships with European countries, Germany, France, other countries in NATO. And the U.K., in a sense, with Brexit, has risked disrupting a relationship with America, which is one which has to be seen more as regional and global now, rather than a one-to-one.
Given all that, Scott, how are Biden and Johnson likely to interact at the G7?
Well, I mean, Biden is an extremely skillful politician, has been at the center of U.S. politics for decades. He'll be extremely cordial with Johnson. He won't do anything to foul the nest, as it were. And it's in Boris Johnson's interest, given that he was a longtime supporter of Donald Trump, indeed was put into number 10 with the help of Trump's people. He'll want to make sure that he puts on the smile for Joe Biden, both as a one-to-one relationship and, of course, the larger stakes for Britain this year. We're still part of the G7. We are going to be hosting the Climate Change Summit in Glasgow in the autumn. So I don't see this as being anything but diplomatic. The question of what substance there's going to be, look, this G7 summit is dealing with issues that go beyond the U.S. and the U.K., the pandemic, the economic consequences of the pandemic, climate change, dealing with issues such as Russia and such as China. And I think Johnson's going to have to accept that Biden will not be looking at the U.K., even as it hosts the G7, as being, one beyond others. And that, I think, is going to be the challenging diplomatic maneuvers that take place this week.
Would you like to be a fly on the wall, or do you reckon it's going to be pretty bland, their discussions?
I always want to be a fly on the wall because I always want to try to figure out where my next storyline is going to come from. But I think the biggest storyline will probably be this, and that is that in the sense of the United States, the adults are back in the room. We didn't necessarily see that in the Trump administration. Indeed, Donald Trump refused to sign off on G7 communiques because they referred to things such as climate change. That's not going to happen this time. The U.S. is there. Again, the idea, however, that the U.K. can spin this in terms of even if we don't have a special relationship, we have pride of place, that's not the reality. And in that respect, that's why Johnson put this statement out. He knows that the special relationship is not a reality in American politics, and so he's sort of dampening a bit of expectations. To be honest with you, from those newspapers and TV channels, who have always led with the term special relationship for decades when they've covered an event like this.
Scott Lucas there, the Emeritus Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. And remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. UK house prices leapt another 9.5% in the year to May, boosted in part by the government's stamp duty holiday, which ends this month. The Halifax said prices rose by more than 22,000 to an average of £261,743. But it also said buyer preferences are shifting in anticipation of a new post-pandemic lifestyle. And the Halifax added that prices are likely to continue to rise despite reaching this historic high. Joining me to discuss this seemingly relentless upward surge is Crawford Taylor, CEO and founder of Nude, which is an app that helps first-time buyers save. Crawford, thanks for joining us. Is it just the stamp duty holiday that's caused this house price exertion going ever upwards?
Not at all. It's been a phenomenon for the last 20, 30 years. There's been an inequality between those that have got a home and those that don't, and a lot of buy-to-let properties. There's low interest rates fueling the availability of low-cost credit. There's been government intervention in terms of quantitative easing with the low interest rates, but also the furlough scheme and others, where people and working from home, people have amassed a huge. Some people have amassed a huge wealth, and they're at home with thinking about things to do and how to spend their money, and moving and buying other houses, or investing in other houses. All these factors have contributed to pushing up house prices.
Your app is about helping first-time buyers, but if it goes on like this, no one's going to ever be able to climb aboard the property ladder, are they?
There will always have to be people at the bottom of the ladder wanting to buy first time for the first time. It just becomes more and more expensive, and then the inequality arises. People talk about the bank of mum and dad helping people onto the property ladder, but not everybody's got a mum and dad with such wealth to help them get on that ladder. And it just, it does make it more and more difficult. But those that put their mind to it and save as much as they can, it might take them longer to get there and a bit more determination. So there'll always be a will and a way of getting there.
The Halifax said that buyer preferences are shifting. So what sort of properties are people now after then?
They're looking not necessarily to live in the centre of cities like London, Birmingham or Edinburgh. They're looking for places with maybe a garden, the ability to walk rather than a flat out into that garden, etc. Maybe more space within a house as well. And with the ability to work from home and not to commute so much enables people to live further out and get more value from the money they have in terms of the space they have.
Now, I'm a right old Cassandra Crawford, and I'm constant. I'm constantly saying the bubble's about to burst. It can't go on like this. But do you think ultimately we are heading for a major price correction in this market?
I don't honestly know. I've been similar to you. I've lived in London. I've lived in Glasgow now, and worked in London. And I keep thinking, oh, a property price is going to crash, and I'll pick up a place. And they never do, not for the last 20 years or so. The way it's getting fueled just now, it's difficult to see with all the things we discussed. The other aspect that's a major impact is the lack of supply of new homes for first-time buyers as well. So there's a demand-supply imbalance. But one would have to think they would have to fall at some point. Whether that's the next year, the next 5 or 10, 15 years, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, at least it gives us something to discuss over dinner with our friends. Crawford Taylor there, CEO and founder of Nude, the app that helps first-time buyers. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcast videos and opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or Andrew at toryboypierce. Reports of the death of the office may have been a little premature. Statistics from the Savills Estate Agency suggest that demand for office space rose fourfold in the last quarter. But will we ever get back to a working life when we spend 5 days a week in the office? Joining me now is Andrew Carter, Chief Executive of the Centre for Cities think tank. Thanks so much for joining us, Andrew. Listen, we're doing this interview remotely, and won't that continue to be done in that way? A lot of office work's going to carry on like that, even when the pandemic subsided, isn't it?
I think some of it will, but I think, you know, we need to distinguish between, you know, what's happened during the pandemic and the lockdown, which is obviously a very extreme situation. I think we have to be careful about assuming that that just carries on as things begin to ease and as the economy reopens, as offices reopen. I think what we've seen in the last 12 months is not necessarily a very good guide for what we'll see over the next 12 or 24 months.
My understanding is that productivity actually went up when we were all working from home. So isn't it to a firm's advantage to keep some of that in the mix when we return to some sort of normality?
Yeah, I think it's some of the data tells us that productivity's gone up. Some of it is a little bit less conclusive on that, and I think it's partly we'll see how that plays out. I think what it's reminded of us all, I think, is whilst we can do certain tasks remotely, like we can have this conversation, what we lose is the kind of innovation and the creativity and the coming together, you know, that face-to-face personal interaction enables to actually think about the problems that we want to resolve, as well as doing the more routine task. And I think that is the distinction that we should have in our minds. It's a sense, of course, there are things that we can do better sitting at our desk or our kitchen table, but we do definitely lose the spark and the creativity that we get when we bring people together. And that, you know, that's really what offices, I suppose, or workplaces are, you know, are partly about.
Anyone who's visited Manchester recently or the City of London will just see huge numbers of new office blocks going up. Are those ever going to be filled now, do you reckon?
I think yes. I mean, again, I think we have to think over the, you know, over the 12 or 24 months. So in the immediate term, the next 12 months, you know, rocky road as we go through this adjustment process. But I'm pretty confident as we look through, you know, 2 to 3 years down the line, that that space is used. Now, it might be used in slightly different ways. You know, the kind of format of that, we might see, you know, more space being provided but actually used slightly intensively as people's working patterns evolve and change. But I still think that there, you know, that we will see that office space being used. I also think, interestingly, you know, we'll see space of different types being available as well. You know, we often think about offices as the kind of classic corporate skyscraper. I think those will have a role. But actually, when you talk to lots of different organizations, thinking about shared space, flexible workspace, that becomes much more prominent. And that's already been a really that's a big, big growth industry over the last 5 to 6 years.
So let's get to the nitty gritty here, Andrew. If you're right, does this mean the demise of Zoom?
No, I don't think the demise of Zoom is a result. I think you will see a sort of more complementary relationship. And actually, I think what we've seen and what we've done over the last 12 months is actually kind of think very carefully about how the sort of telecommunications and remote working infrastructure can actually complement the face-to-face. I think we often think about them as being in conflict. We should think of them being actually much more as a complement. So we'll do some things on Zoom, but we'll definitely do more face-to-face than we've done over the last 12 months.
And do you think people will travel? I mean, if it's easy, it's so easy to set up a conference call on Zoom with your colleagues in Newcastle and you're based in Plymouth. Is that going to stop us actually getting together, do you think?
I think we'll be more deliberate about our travel. In a sense, you know, we may well fall out of this sort of automaton approach. You know, we get on the train or the bus or in our car 5 days a week because it's what we do. I think workers and firms will be much more deliberate about what is it that we want to achieve when we bring our people together, and therefore, you know, to be much more mindful about that. So you might find that, you know, you travel a little bit less, but the reasons for why you travel are much more considered and thought through than maybe what they historically, you know, have been. So in some respects, I think you see an increased value to travel. The other thing I would say on travel is that as individuals, we might travel less. We might only go into the office 3 days or 4 days a week. But what that means is if you actually are only traveling in or, less frequently, you might ultimately find more people making that journey than previous. Because in a sense, you know, they live further away, but actually the office becomes more of the hub for a greater suite of people. So actually more people travel, even if the individual is traveling slightly less.
Really interesting. Many thanks to Andrew Carter there, Chief Executive of the Centre for Cities. Now it's time for our regular update on the world of sport with Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor at the Daily Mail. Now, Matt, there's a lot of archaeology going on to search for historic offensive cricketing tweets. Are we in danger of overshadowing something that is going to happen, you know, Jimmy Anderson-wise in the next test?
Well, we are. I mean, you know, it's such a thorny issue, and the ECB have tied themselves in knots, really, with this whole thing over the historical tweets. Obviously, this was kicked off by the Ollie Robinson tweets that came out last week and overshadowed his test debut. Now, there's another unnamed England cricketer who was also tweeting something when he was 15 years old. The ECB haven't decided quite how they're going to deal with that one. There's other tweets that came up yesterday involving Owen Morgan and Joss Butler, which weren't brilliant, but were a while ago as well. So it's a bit of a mess. And the ECB have basically gone to ground while they work out exactly how they're going to deal with this. And of course, who knows what else will be come up. Now that it's sort of fair game to go through people's Twitter histories and find out what's going on, or what they've said in the past, you know, there could be plenty more to come. So it's a really tough one for the ECB, but it feels like, to me personally, that they've gone way over the top in some of the reaction to what Robinson did 10 years ago, and they've made a sort of rod for their own back. And yes, all this, as you say, rightly, is overshadowing the fact that Jimmy Anderson is about to win his 162nd cap, and will become the most capped England cricketer, overtaking Alistair Cook, which for a fast bowler is just phenomenal. If you look at the list of sort of the top 10 They're all batsmen, and Jimmy's in there as well, so superb effort by him.
Now, I don't know if you've noticed, Matt, but I think the Euros are about to start, aren't they? Seems to have gone quiet on that front.
Someone did mention that.
Yeah. Jordan Henderson of England has been having a bit of a row with Roy Keane. Unusual for Roy to get involved in a row, but what's this all about?
Very unusual for Roy Keane. I don't know what's come over him, but he at the weekend in his... in true Roy Keane fashion, suggested that Jordan Henderson shouldn't be anywhere near the England squad because he obviously, until Sunday in the last warm-up game, hadn't really kicked a ball in anger for his club side Liverpool since February time. So Roy Keane, in typical blunt fashion, questioned whether he was there and suggested that maybe he's good at quiz nights or juggling tricks or something like that. And that's what's got him on the... That's what's got him into the squad. Well, obviously, Henderson was not having that yesterday and said that, it wasn't to do with his quiz setting ability. It was more to do with his footballing ability, and he intended to, do all he could to play a full part in the tournament. Now, that obviously remains to be seen. He can't be fit. So you wouldn't think he'd play this Sunday when England kick off their tournament against Croatia. And we'll see who has the last laugh. If Henderson scores the winner in the final, then maybe he'll have the last laugh over Keane. If he doesn't kick a ball, Keane might be the one giggling.
If Henderson scores the winner in the final, it won't be from the penalty spot, that's for sure. Phil Foden, he's gone full... Lots of pictures of Phil Foden. He's gone full Gazza Euro 96 with his new haircut. Do you reckon that he might have as much of an impact on this tournament as his sartorial role model did 25 years ago?
Well, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? Because that would be, evoking the memories of Euro 96 would be coming up again. So that would be superb. We can but dream. It remains to be seen whether Foden even makes the starting lineup. We know that Southgate's a big fan of his sort of front three that he's tried and trusted over the last few years of Rashford, Kane and Sterling. So it even remains to be seen whether Foden, with his Gazza haircut or not, gets in the starting 11. I personally hope he does. I think he's had a superb season. I think he's a wonderful player. I think he's the closest thing we've had to a kind of Gazza type player. The way he can, low centre of balance, the way he can beat a player. I think he's wonderful to watch. I think he's great. He's just what, he gets you off your seat. So I'd love to see him in the team. And I hope that if he's given a fair crack of the whip, he could have an impact as big as Gazza. And let's hope that he's a little bit taller and he could get his stud on that ball that Gazza missed so memorably all those years ago and get us to a final. But we'll see. It remains to be seen whether he starts, but I hope he does.
I hope he does as well. And I hope he's got that celebration as well, scoring a goal.
That would be brilliant, yeah.
And then doing the dentist chair.
That would be
fantastic.
Good.
Oh, gosh, we are old if we can remember that. Thanks so much, Matt Gabwood, Deputy Sports Editor at the Daily Mail. New government targets could mean that homeowners face bills of tens of thousands of pounds to make their properties greener. The Climate Change Committee, an official advisory body, recently called for all homes to have an Energy Performance Certificate, or an EPC, grade of C or higher within 10 to 15 years, which means owners may be forced to shell out for better insulation and to replace gas boilers. And banks and building societies may refuse to offer mortgages on drafty homes, with lenders being encouraged to reward energy-efficient homeowners with cheaper deals. So to tell us what this really means is that I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Amelia Murray, Chief Money Mail reporter of the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us, Amelia. Will this make it more difficult to sell inefficient homes?
So at the moment, it's all very much speculation. We've been given this target of 10 to 15 years where, we're being encouraged to upgrade our homes. And this is kind of all part of the government's strategy to be net zero by 2050. So just to explain what that means, it's all to do with, environmental awareness. And it means that by 2050, they want the UK to be neutral in terms of its carbon footprint, the amount of carbon it's putting in the atmosphere and the amount it's taking away. So, I mean, altogether, it's a good thing for everyone. However, when it sort of boils down to like the nitty gritty, it does look quite challenging. So in terms of the inefficient homes, it's not just about money, although this is kind of what I focused on for the story, because I think it's something that hasn't been properly thought through. What would be beneficial to homeowners by having a grade C property with regards to energy efficiency is it will mean that your house is more comfortable, less drafty. It will mean that, you know, your carbon footprint has been reduced. So that's kind of all good things for homeowners. However, you know, it could mean that mortgage lenders are tightening up on their criteria and they may not want to lend, to certain graded homes. We've already seen this in buy-to-let because there are rules in place there. Properties to get a buy-to-let mortgage have to be above a certain grade. So we could see mortgage lenders tighten up criteria because it will, you know, they'll become more difficult to sell as the kind of the targets become closer. And it could be that, you know, people don't want to take the risk. They don't want to actually have to pay the tens of thousands of pounds it's going to cost to upgrade their homes and make them more energy efficient. It's going to be an interesting time. But of course, all it is now at the moment is we're kind of speculating what could happen.
I take your point there. I also take your point about it's going to make your house actually nicer to live in. But just give us an idea. You said it's going to take a long time for homeowners to make their money back if they have to fork out like that. How long?
Oh, wow. Well, I put a number of examples in the story. We're talking more than 50 years to make the money back. And this is, you know, once you pay the upfront cost to say wall insulation or loft insulation or all of these kind of recommended eco measures, it then calculates your potential annual saving on the energy bills. So one property that I looked at, it was a 2-bed flat in South London. It was the recommended measures totted up to almost £16,000, but the annual energy saving was only £298. So you'd have to, you know, remain in that property for, I think, it's like 53 years to make that money back.
Well, it better be a comfortable property, 53 years. If we're all going to be forced to replace gas boilers, what do we replace them with?
So the ban that's been proposed isn't to replace gas boilers. The ban is to, you know, with the new ones. So this is a kind of a discussion which the government is currently sort of talking about. It's a cut-off date of 2035. And this is when the use of gas boilers in existing homes will be phased out. So at the moment, there's not a discussion about replacing your old boilers. It's just about, you know, putting in the more energy efficient ones in new homes. So there are a number of kind of, you know, more efficient boilers and air pumps, those kind of things. But they can cost between £5,000 and £10,000. Like, they're not cheap. So again, there is time to discuss how we can, you know, make these more more viable for homeowners. Because, I mean, I think you'll agree, we do want to do better for the environment. We do want more comfortable homes. But at the moment, there doesn't really seem to be the incentive for people to do it because not everyone's got this amount of money lying around.
Good point. Incentive is part of it. Do you think there will be inevitably grants made available to make our homes more energy efficient?
So this is what the story was kind of getting at. It wasn't just sort of talking about, you know, it not being viable for homeowners. It was to encourage the government to introduce more incentives and more grants and schemes to encourage homeowners to help them meet the government targets. We've had the recently failed Green Home Grant that lasted months before it kind of all crumbled, and that was offering homeowners in England £5,000 towards certain eco measures, which was, you know, they'd kind of recommended, but it was just dogged with, it was chaos. I mean, it just didn't work out. And we've also seen sort of history repeat itself with other well-intentioned but not particularly well-executed schemes. What we have got is the renewable heat incentive, which is a type of grant, is coming to an end, and it's going to be replaced by the clean heat grant next year. And this is giving homeowners sort of money up front to help them install a heat pump system, which is a more energy efficient device for your home. So that's kind of what we know at the moment. I think this is what these stories are for, aren't they? To kind of encourage the government to really look at what they can offer homeowners to, you know, to help them, to help us, to help the planet, you know, for the greater good at the end of the day. But yeah, we're still waiting for kind of more to come forward.
Oh, many thanks, Amelia. I'm just off to go and line my loft. That was Amelia Murray, Chief Money Mail Reporter at the Daily Mail. That's all we have time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. And every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to Andrew all over again. I'm Jim White, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show. The main man will be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening. Good night.